Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed Hosting Services, providing application management, hosting, professional services, security services, and compliance solutions for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
Losing his job may have been the best thing that ever happened to Lee Child. When a television company in his native England let him go after 18 years, Mr. Child tried his hand at writing thrillers. And 13 years and almost as many books later, his Jack Reacher novels, which are set in America, have become international bestsellers. According to one calculation, last year they sold at a rate of 1 per second. Nothing to Lose is the 12th installment in the series, and I'm very pleased it has brought Lee Child to the show. Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. When you were thinking about what kind of hero you'd create, did you look back to the British tradition of eccentrics and intellectuals or to the more troubled, hard-boiled types that Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler used to give us?
I actually didn't look back or try and make a conscious decision at all because I felt that to specify too closely, to worry about it too much, was going to make a wooden or cardboard type of character. I was completely aware that this had to work, you know, the character had to be good. But at the same time, I was completely aware that I just had to close my mind and navigate by gut instinct. Otherwise, you end up with a kind of laundry list of imagined virtues that were applicable 3 or 4 years ago in the market, and you really get nowhere.
But Jack Reacher does remind me in some ways of the Toshiro Mifune itinerant samurai character in Kurosawa's films Yojimbo and Sanjuro. He wanders into a town and becomes aware that something's happening and somehow gets involved.
That's absolutely true. And also, of course, he's very reminiscent of Shane or any of the Zane Grey Western heroes. But that's really because there's a much earlier precedent for all of this, which is really the mythic figure from medieval Europe or further back even in the Norse sagas or Anglo-Saxon battle poems, the mysterious loner. And he's had a variety of names, the Shogun Warrior, as you point out, the Pale Rider, the Knight Errant. It's a universal figure from our history. And so I felt that to combine thoroughly modern contemporary stories involving present-day issues with this much more legendary main character would be attractive, because you've got to ask yourself, why was this character invented over and over again every 100 years or so throughout history? And it must only be that we need this guy to exist.
Somebody who's rootless, so rootless that he wanders the country with only a toothbrush and an ATM card in his pockets.
Yeah, my motto is everything I need and nothing I don't, and that's about as far as you can get it.
And I'm assuming his name is a clue to an aspect of his identity, Jack Reacher.
Well, that's only when you look at it retrospectively. I'm really bad at making up names, and as you said, I was out of work and broke, and I had a family to support at the time, and my wife was naturally interested in what I was going to do. And because I was out of work, I was available to do errands, and I went with her to the supermarket one day. And every time that I'm in a supermarket, because I'm tall, a little old lady will say to me, would you reach me that can? And my wife, Jane, said, you know what, if this writing gig doesn't work out, you could be a reacher in a supermarket. And I thought, wow, that's a great name. And the kind of dynamic aspects only struck me afterward.
But you interestingly have set these books in the United States rather than in Great Britain.
Yeah, because this type of character, if you think about it, needs a huge geography. He needs a landscape in which to roam. And
In England, you go 12 miles and you're in another town and there's a different accent.
Yeah, exactly. And, some of my books have spanned huge distances. The second book, there's a kidnap in Chicago and the victims are driven 2,000 miles to the Rockies, which is obviously possible in America, not possible in Britain. If you'd been kidnapped where I lived and driven 2,000 miles, you're in Algeria. And so, you know, we need this vast empty landscape for this character to work in, which is why the American setting was so much more attractive.
Although Jack Reacher isn't 100% American. His mother is French. He grew up on military bases all around the world.
Yeah, the idea was to make him thoroughly disconnected, somewhat alienated and rootless. And I just made a bunch of arbitrary decisions at the beginning, really, about the French mother. That was just a way of saying, look, this guy is from all over the world. He's really a metaphor as well as a person.
Have European readers been as enthusiastic about Jack Reacher as Americans have?
Yeah, their reaction has been different. America and Britain have reacted in exactly the same way, but when you get across the channel to Western Europe, they're very enthusiastic, the books sell very well, but they're somewhat appalled that they're liking them because the guy is such a vigilante. You know, they eat it up, but they think, oh, I shouldn't be liking this.
Well, you have a law degree. Why have Jack Reacher be a vigilante rather than a private detective or even a police officer?
Well, a private detective or a police officer is a kind of refinement of this character. It's a narrowing down of the character, and I didn't want to narrow it down into a specific location or a specific job. But when you study law like I did, you realize there's laws are kind of temporary and malleable, and there's a huge gap between law and order. People say law and order as if it's the same thing, but the more law you have, the less order. The more order you want, the less law you need. And so it's an exploration, really, of what happens on the margins of the law.
You're talking about narrowing things down. You have not even narrowed it down to a voice. You've written some of these things in first person, some in third person.
Yeah, I prefer the first person because it's a very natural way of telling stories that we all do that. You know, we say, I did this today, I did that. We don't refer to ourselves in the third person unless we're seriously weird. But some stories...
Or a politician.
Yeah. Some stories just can't be told in the first person because they depend on an alternative third-person point of view. The meanwhile back at the ranch strand you can't do in first person. So I would always prefer first person, but very often the story demands third person.
I'm talking with Lee Child, whose latest Jack Reacher novel is called Nothing to Lose. And it is published by Delacorte Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In this book, there are these two towns, Hope and Despair.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I hope you didn't get the idea for those towns in the supermarket as well.
No, that's from just traveling around, where in the West there are towns with frivolous and exotic names. You know, you could write a whole book about the names of towns out there. And it was metaphorical in the sense that those towns often were. They were usually stops along wagon train trails. And the point I was trying to make with this one is that the Rockies are up ahead of you. They're your last barrier. And it's an awesome barrier. And in certain parts of eastern Colorado, they look really close because the land is very flat and the air is very clear. And you think, wow, okay, a couple of days and we're there. And then you move on even just a few miles, and something about the landscape changes, and suddenly the mountains look 1,000 miles away. And so you go from hope to despair in terms of how you're feeling about the journey.
And using those names allowed you a little bit of wordplay throughout the novel.
Yeah, quite. It was probably the most allegorical story I've tried. And, you know, it is a constant back and forth between hope and despair physically, but also in terms of the mood of the story.
Not just allegorical, it may be the most overtly political Reacher novel yet. Is that because you open up the newspaper and can't help but think that you have to get involved, like Jack Reacher?
Yeah, I mean, part of Jack Reacher's personality is that he will not pass by on the other side of the street. But I'm fascinated by the way it's been called political, because really the point of the book and Reacher's point in the book is that these issues are actually way beyond politics. Politics is about, should income tax be 39% or 36%? Should health care be mandated or not? That's politics. If society asks somebody to risk life or limb in its service, then that is actually a transaction way beyond politics. So really the book was a provocation to people to call it political. And I think if they call it political, they're part of the problem and not part of the solution.
Well, but it does deal with the aftermath of the war in Iraq.
It does. It deals with the aftermath in terms of the human wreckage and the physical wreckage. Mostly it deals with that proposition that if that duty, that the duty that soldiers owe to their nation is actually a two-way street. The nation owes a duty to its soldiers. And if that transaction is being interrupted, like I believe it is right now, then actually that's not political. That's far more basic.
Well, the U.S. military almost always plays a role in the Reacher novels. Have you done a lot of research into the inner workings of the Army?
Yeah. I mean, all my research is lifelong. I think if you try and research a book specifically that year, you end up somehow out of balance, and it's too hard to put it into context and proportion. So I try and rely on stuff that I've read and heard and known for years and years. And the U.S. military is, of course, has been for 60-plus years, just a massive institution, world famous. It's not secret. It's all over the world, available for inspection all the time, quite rightly celebrated, quite rightly criticized in some ways, and the information is there. It's actually not hard to research. It's actually hard to avoid.
Well, it's in the news a lot, but you've also touched in books on issues like illegal immigration. And didn't Dick Cheney make an appearance in one of the books, unnamed, but
yeah,
hard to miss?
Well, you had to be a political junkie to pick up the reference. It was the Secretary of Defense was mentioned tied to a time when Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense. So, yeah, he did not escape Reacher's wrath either.
Hmm. And you did that because you were having some fun?
Yeah, because, I mean, Reacher is an intelligent person who is not bound by any ideology, or he's not bound by any kind of party loyalty, and he will call it as he sees it. And I think it's a fairly obvious proposition to say that there have been some politicians have performed better than other politicians. And I think
in our country and in your country.
In every country. And I think that to be partisan about who you praise and who you condemn is immature. I think we should call it as we see it.
For a good part of the book, it's unclear if anyone in despair has even committed a crime. Where does Reacher get this insatiable urge to poke his nose into other people's business?
That's pretty much autobiographical. I'm the sort of guy who needs to know things, wants to know things, and won't leave things alone.
But in his case, he walks into a situation without being asked and says, I, Jack Reacher, will sort this whole thing out.
Well, to be fair, he walks in and says, I want a cup of coffee. And then when he, instead of getting a cup of coffee, he gets a vagrancy bust and hauled back to the town line. That is pretty much a red rag to a bull with Reacher. The proposition of the book is if he'd gotten his cup of coffee, he would have moved on and left the place exactly as he found it. But if you pick on him, he will push back at you.
Well, you said that a lot of it is based on yourself. Do you also have an obsession with finding the perfect coffee mug?
Absolutely. I think coffee is the perfect drink, and the next thing to do is find the perfect receptacle for it.
Has anyone offered you any coffee here?
Have you
checked out the WNYC mug?
The WNYC mug is a pretty good mug, but it's not perfect.
Well, I think that's true of almost everything. I would say that that's probably true of me as well.
Well, I think
you're good, but not perfect.
Yeah, but you've got a long track record. You're erring on the side of the angels, I think.
Jack Reacher is quite macho. Do you find your readers are mostly men?
Actually, I think they're pretty evenly split, possibly even more women than men.
Why do you think that is?
I think, well, women buy more fiction anyway than men. And there's something about Reacher that appeals to women. In as much as Reacher, for all that he's this huge, macho, masculine, physical character, he has a very feminine approach to injustice. In my experience as a person, women, much more than men, are offended at a basic level by injustice. If you ever hear a person slam their hand on the table and say, it's just not fair, that's likely to be a woman. And Reacher feels the same. He cannot walk away from injustice. And I think women find that narrative arc very satisfying.
One of the big problems for people who write book series is coming up with new things about the regular characters. You don't have to worry about that all that much because Jack Reacher is your only recurring character. But when you started this, you had no idea that you would be writing a dozen books, and I'm sure more in the offing.
I didn't, because you can't afford to be that unrealistic.
But did you imagine you'd be writing a series?
I hoped I would be. Certainly I hoped I would be, and I hoped it would be successful, and I hoped it would last forever. So I left myself some wiggle room, which, as you say, this is not a soap opera. There's no job, no location, no house, no friends, no neighbors, no dog.
No wife, no ex-wife.
Exactly. No trauma in the past, no repertory cast around him. There's just Reacher, which actually builds in an awful lot of flexibility. Because, as you say, for other series, imagine any other series, randomly. Let's say there's a police lieutenant in Chicago.
Had an alcoholic problem somewhere down the line and is fighting the urge to go back.
Yeah.
Also smokes every so often and then tries not to go back to cigarette smoking.
All those cliches. But fundamentally, every page one of his book is the same because he's doing police-type stuff in Chicago. And therefore, I can imagine that is much more of a challenge than my series, because with Reacher, he can be anywhere doing anything. The palette is unlimited geographically. It's also unlimited in terms of pitch. Some of the stories have been glossy, DC involved, FBI, White House, all that kind of thing. Some stories like this one are just dusty, no-account towns in the back of beyond. And that sort of flexibility means that for me, every page one is a brand new thing.
Had you had no temptation to write a book or two based in England with somebody else?
No, because England produces very different kind of fiction. It's a very internal, claustrophobic, psychological type of crime fiction, geographically very tight. Most of the action is in people's heads. And for me, I just love the big skies, the open landscapes, and the roaming.
Yeah, we can't imagine Lord Peter Wimsey in Wyoming.
You really can't. Although Lord Peter Wimsey was a great, great series of its time, with a very valuable lesson for me, actually, because I loved that series. I read that series. I've reread it many, many times. And you can actually kind of notice a point at which the author, Dorothy Sayers, falls in love with her own character. And at that point, the series goes downhill, in my opinion. And that taught me very much to make sure I like Reacher a little bit less than I hope you're going to like him. That way, it keeps him raw and honest and stops him from becoming just a sugary kind of confection.
So you give him certain negative characteristics.
Yeah, unsparingly. I mean, he is arrogant. I think you're hinting at it a little bit. He won't leave things alone. He pokes his nose in where he's not wanted. And that is a kind of arrogance. Each book is really a conflict between his arrogance and the arrogance of his opponent. And he finds that kind of challenge irresistible, which to some extent is immature, to some extent is unattractive, but he has to do it.
You were a TV writer and a director for 18 years before you took up writing books. Do you think that writing for the screen has influenced the way you write the novels?
I think only very, very tangentially, in as much as I learned that it's all about the audience. It's the audience first, second, third, and fourth. Too many writers write to impress their friends or their colleagues or their writing groups. They write to appear cool. That way lies failure. It's about the audience only. And the second thing it taught me is just get it done. As you know, TV, radio, the broadcast media are insatiable in terms of how much they consume. So you just got to get it done, get it finished, and move on to the next thing. And so I'm very comfortable with deadlines now, that's for sure.
Well, if you do TV series, you're doing pretty much the same thing, aren't you?
Yeah, but TV series need to be done fast and on schedule. Most of TV, the glamorous image of TV is actually not true. I mean, most of TV is some kind of industrial crisis management. Things just go wrong all the time. It's a miracle anything gets made in a broadcastable manner. And so writing, you don't have physical problems. You don't show up and a hydraulic crane is not working that morning. You don't show up and find half the lights won't work or the electricity is out. You can just sit there and everything is always available.
Also, you can determine how things are going to go. I spoke some years ago to Fritz Weaver about his appearance on a science fiction series in America. And I asked him whether he knew when he took the part, whether he was going to be one of the good aliens or the bad aliens. And he said, I wondered about that. And I went to the director and I asked him. And he said, you know, I haven't seen the next script. I have no idea. Why don't you go and ask Joe, the director of the next one? And he went to Joe and Joe said, I have no idea either. So he said he played it straight down the middle, which worked quite well. But still, you have to wonder about how those things sometimes how they work out and why. And it also explains why sometimes they don't work out all that well.
Yeah, and that also illustrates the major difference between TV and writing books, which is that TV is a team effort. You know, minimum of 100 people involved in everything. And as you point out, the major decisions belong to somebody else. With writing, there's only one person involved. I mean, obviously, in the real world, there are editors and publishers and booksellers and so on. But fundamentally, it's about one mind connecting with the reader's mind.
But you could have also have written screenplays. And these days, many novelists are moonlighting as scriptwriters. We have Michael Cunningham. I think he's pretty much not writing novels anymore. We have Richard Price, who's career is largely in writing films, although he does continue to write novels, and I'm sure I come up with a pretty long list. You've gone in the opposite direction, haven't you?
Yeah, I have done one or two screenplays along the way, and there's an unsatisfying unreality about them to me, because at this point in my publishing career, if I sit down to write a book, barring some gigantic catastrophe, I know for certain that that book will be published. Because it's contracted and it's expected and so on. If I sit down and write a screenplay, I know for certain that that will not be made. Probably not at all, and certainly not in the form that I've written it. If it ever gets made 2 years down the road, it will be altered by a dozen other people.
The director will say, this scene really is not working.
I
have a whole new vision for this story.
Exactly. The vision thing and the right on the day of the shoot, the actor will say, I'm not saying that line. And so there's an unreality about it, that you're sitting there working very hard on something that you know won't happen. And ultimately, that's very unsatisfying.
But haven't all the books been optioned for movies?
They have, yeah.
None of them made?
None of them made. They're all in development. People ask me, is there a movie in the pipeline? And I say, yes, I'm sure there is, but it's an extremely long pipeline and it's very dark in there. I don't know what's happening.
So you don't want to have a hand in writing these scripts?
I don't, because I've learned from the couple of screenplays that I have done that you need to have distance and a kind of callousness about the original material. You need to rip it up and put it back together again in a screenable form. And I learned that if you have nothing invested in the original product, that's much easier to do effectively. I already think the books are good, and so I would be very nervous about altering them and tearing them down. So I think it's absolutely necessary that a third party kind of triangulates this process.
Hey, you've written pretty much one a year since you started writing them. Does that mean that you write them quickly and don't go through many drafts?
Well, I write them. I used to think I was quick, and then, you know, the more other writers you get to meet, you realize other people are much quicker, some are much slower. I'm about there in the middle of the pack. And in terms of drafts, I do one draft, but everybody does it differently. Some people just rush through the first draft and then take their main enjoyment in the revision. I don't. I do it fairly slowly and patiently, and each page, each section, I make sure is perfect before I move on to the next. So fundamentally, I deliver draft one, although if you wanted to be accurate about it, it's probably draft 100, because every day I check what I did yesterday. So it's been checked many, many times.
Well, since some of these plots get rather complex, I'm assuming that you have pretty much worked it all out before you start.
Actually, no. I never work anything out before I start. I just start at the beginning and see where it takes me. And the complexity is it's neat. It's tied up in the end. But that's a sort of retrospective effect because, as you said before, the author's in complete control.
So is that the hard part at the end? Now I have to tie up all the loose ends?
Yeah. Because
did I miss a loose end?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a challenge. I think people find it very satisfying that loose ends are tied up, which is actually the nature of the point of fiction, because real life is not satisfying from that point of view. You know, real life, not much ever gets fixed or decided. And with fiction, you can provide the satisfaction of saying, yeah, you know, order is restored, closure is achieved, and all these loose ends are explained.
Do you think that you could have been as successful if you'd started writing novels from the start?
I think not, and I think that's the great thing about writing novels is it's not only something that you can do later in life, it's something that you should do later in life. I think that people who start straight out of college or novelists in their 20s struggle because there's just not enough in to let it all out.
Lee Child is the author of 12 Jack Reacher thrillers, including New York Times bestsellers Persuader, The Enemy, One Shot, The Hard Way, and Bad Luck and Trouble. His latest is called Nothing to Lose. It is published by Delacorte Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.